This academic year, God willing, we're looking at the first half of the prophecy of Isaiah. And this morning we're in chapter 5. If you've one of the church turquoise Bibles, that begins on page 690. 690. Let's hear God's word to us from Isaiah chapter 5. I will sing for the one I love, a song about his vineyard. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it and cut out a wine press as well. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. Now you dwellers in Jerusalem and people of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done for my vineyard than I've done for it? When I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? Now I will tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge and it will be destroyed. I will break down its wall and it will be trampled. I will make it a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated, and briars and thorns will grow there. I will command the clouds not to rain on it. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the nation of Israel, and the people of Judah are the vines he delighted in. He looked for justice but saw bloodshed, for righteousness but heard cries of distress. Woe to you who add house to house and join field to field till no space is left, and you live alone in the land. The Lord Almighty has declared in my hearing, surely the great houses will become desolate, the fine mansions left without occupants. A 10-acre vineyard will produce only a bath of wine. A homer of seed will yield only an ephah of grain. Woe to those who rise early in the morning to run after their drinks, who stay up late at night till they are inflamed with wine. They have harps and lyres at their banquets, pipes and tambourines and wine, but they have no regard for the deeds of the Lord, no respect for the work of his hands. Therefore my people will go into exile for lack of understanding. Those of high rank will die of hunger, and the common people will be parched with thirst. Therefore death expands its jaws, opening wide its mouth. Into it will descend their nobles and masses with their brawlers and revelers. So people will be brought low and everyone humbled, the eyes of the arrogant humbled. But the Lord Almighty will be exalted by his justice, and the holy God will be proved holy by his righteous acts. Then sheep will graze as in their own pasture. Lambs will feed among the ruins of the rich. Woe to those who draw sin along with cords of deceit and wickedness as with cart ropes, to those who say, let God hurry, let him hasten his work so that we may see it. The plan of the Holy One of Israel, let it approach, let it come into view so we may know it. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine and champions at mixing drinks, who acquit the guilty for a bribe but deny justice to the innocent. Therefore, as tongues of fire lick up straw and as dry grass sinks down in the flames, so their roots will decay and their flowers blow away like dust. For they have rejected the law of the Lord Almighty and spurned the word of the Holy One of Israel. Therefore the Lord's anger burns against his people. His hand is raised and he strikes them down. The mountains shake and the dead bodies are like refuse in the streets. Yet for all this his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. He lifts up a banner for the distant nations. He whistles for those at the ends of the earth. Here they come, swiftly, and speedily. Not one of them grows tired or stumbles. Not one slumbers or sleeps. Not a belt is loosened at the waist. Not a sandal strap is broken. Their arrows are sharp, all their bows are strung. Their horses' hooves seem like flint. Their chariot wheels like a whirlwind. Their roar is like that of the lion. They roar like young lions. They growl as they seize their prey and carry it off with no one to rescue. In that day, they will roar over it like the roaring of the sea. And if one looks at the land, there is only darkness and distress. Even the sun will be darkened by clouds. In our family, we sometimes play one of these silly games. Maybe you do too. It's quite fun in an idle moment. We say to each other, if you were a dog, what kind of dog would you be? Sometimes we even say, if you were a dog, I know what kind of dog you would be. That's quite interesting. If you were a vegetable, what kind would you be? If you were a flower, what kind would you be? The question this passage poses is, if you were a vine, what kind of grapes would you produce? If you can imagine yourself as a vine in a vineyard, what kind of grapes would your life be producing right now? It's a question the passage poses to us as individuals, but also as a church and as a society. Are we fruitful in the way that we could be and should be? Or are we guilty of the tragedy of unfruitfulness? And if so, what can we do about it? What can we do to become more fruitful? The book of Isaiah is an amazing collection of prophecies given by this man who was God's spokesman to his nation in his time. The book as we have it is a collection of his words uttered over many decades, put together either by him or perhaps by one of his colleagues, either towards the end of his life, maybe shortly after, as we don't exactly know, but put together in this form to help those people and to help future generations to see the way God sees things. Because what was true for them is in so many ways true for us. The only chapters of Isaiah are a little bit strange or puzzling or unusual in this respect. Very often when you've got a prophet, they start with their account of becoming a prophet. And right at the beginning, there'll be something about how God came to them, appeared to them, spoke to them about becoming a prophet. That's what you find in Jeremiah. It's what you find in Ezekiel. You find in other places. But in Isaiah, that is delayed until chapter 6. And we'll be looking at that next week. Chapter 6 could have been chapter 1, but it isn't. Instead, as Isaiah or someone else put this collection together, what we see is a 5-chapter introduction building up to what is, I think, the most amazing chapter, certainly in the first part of Isaiah, chapter 6, and his call. And what he's doing in chapters 1 to 5 is something like this, I think. He's taking some of the messages which he preached after he became a prophet to express his understanding of the situation he came into to minister. In other words, from his ministry after his call, he's kind of bringing them forward and using that as the introduction to build up to chapter 6. And what we find, therefore, in chapters 1 to 5 is him using these messages which came later to analyze his society in the time of King Uzziah, because his call came in the year King Uzziah died. Now, that society was a peaceful and prosperous one. In fact, they'd enjoyed decades of peace and prosperity, and people were very happy with it. But in chapters 1 to 4, we see critiques of that and critiques of the sin that was lying under the surface, warnings of the consequences of that sin and the judgment that was to come. Woven into chapters 1 to 4, though, are both small hints in odd verses and huge statements, beginning of chapter 2 and the whole of chapter 4. Small hints and huge statements of mercy, mingled in, interleaved with the statements of judgment. It insists that God is in charge, and he is a God of judgment, but he's also one of forgiveness and renewal and change. One of those great statements is chapter 4. And it's a wonderful statement of God coming in and cleansing and being with his people. And then we come to chapter 5. And it is as if no one has been listening. Now Isaiah essentially has to keep saying the same thing. But he realizes he needs a new approach to gain their attention. So he does something creative. Chapter 5, verse 1. I will sing. He sings a song. I think I can understand a little of the desire to find fresh ways of making an impact when one becomes rather familiar as a preacher, but my family would be very relieved to know that I don't intend to follow in these particular footsteps. Isaiah could sing better than me, no doubt, and he does. I will sing for the one I love. And you can imagine their interest, whetted. That's not what Isaiah normally sounds like. Well, this is interesting. This is a bit of a change. But actually, the whole thing is calculated to get under their defences in a new way and to open them up to God's examination as to whether they're fruitful or not. We're going to look at it in four stages. And as ever, you can find a little outline of this on the right-hand side at the bottom of the bulletin that sometimes help people to stay on track as we go through it. The four stages we're going to look at it are these. First of all, the unfruitful vineyard. Is it us? Verses 1 to 7. Then, bitter grapes. Are they growing in our lives? Verses 8 to 25. Then, the results of unfruitfulness. What will God do in response to it? 25 to 30. And then we'll finish with the true vine and how Jesus can make our lives fruitful. It starts with this picture of the unfruitful vineyard. And we need to be asking ourselves all the way through, is this a picture of us? I will sing for the one I love, says Isaiah. Sounds like a love song. And incidentally, sometimes people are a little bit critical of some of the songs that are sung these days in churches in which Jesus is addressed as a beloved or a lover. Well, sometimes they can be a bit sentimental, but it has a very good biblical pedigree. At least Isaiah's song described the Lord as his beloved. So it sounds like a love song, and their interest would have been whetted, but then it takes an unexpected turn, because it's a song about the beloved's vineyard, and that is the focus. And it may be a little bit of an over-imaginative reconstruction, but can you imagine Isaiah with a guitar strolling into a national festival, perhaps the famous national festival, where actually they celebrated the grape harvest coming in? That would have been a very appropriate setting. And they think, oh, he's not giving us a difficult prophecy now. He's just singing this song, and it's a grape song, a great song about grapes and all the rest of it, and their defences are lowered. My loved one had a vineyard, he says, on a perfect site, this fertile hillside. But it needed work. He dug it up and cleared it of stones. Much of Palestine has got limestone outcrops, and there are loads and loads of stones. You want to farm there, you've got to shift stones. And so the owner of the vineyard is in the song doing that. And then he planted it with the choicest of vines, the very best vine stock, to show that it was permanent. He then had a watchtower, cut out a wine press so that he could make wine from it. That was the idea. And then it says he looked for a crop of good grapes. Now, it takes 2 years for a vine to produce. So there was some waiting here. But he was waiting expectantly. He'd done all the right things. There should be grapes there. The 2 years pass, and then what happens? The end of verse 2 is very shocking. It yielded only bad fruit. Bad fruit means stink fruit. Sometimes it's translated as wild grapes, which are just terribly bitter and sour and almost inedible to the taste. You can't make good juice. You certainly can't make wine. Even the raisins are not very good. If it was us, we'd put it straight in the recycling bin outside. We wouldn't even want to keep it in the kitchen. Do you note the sound of deep disappointment here? He'd done everything that was right. What had happened? Then in verse 3, the song changes voice. And rather than Isaiah talking about the vineyard owner, his beloved, now the vineyard owner speaks. Now you dwellers in Jerusalem and people of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. He draws them in. He invites them in. Always a great thing to do when we're engaging with people. Get them to ask questions, but also to answer questions. And he invites them to judge. He says, you assess it. Verse 4, what more could have been done for my vineyard than I've done for it? And you look back and the track record of the owner is perfect. It's so poignant. But it's also so argued, it's not mere sentiment. He'd done all the right things. But, he says, when I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? He almost can't believe it. Well, what's his response? Verse 5. He's going to grub it up again. No, he's not quite going to grub it up. He's going to let other forces grub it up. He's going to take away the hedge. He's going to take away the wall. So the wild animals can come in, perhaps wild boars and other things, and just destroy it. He's going to neglect it. And you know what happens when you neglect a patch of ground? All sorts of weeds and other things come in and they take over so quickly. Anyone who's a gardener knows what this is like. He gives up on it. Now remember, up to this point for his hearers, this could have just been a rather sad song about a disappointed farmer. But at the end of verse 6, if you look, it becomes clear that it's more than that. I will command the clouds not to rain on it. And they're going, This is no ordinary vineyard owner, is it? That can only be God. And while they're absorbing the implications of that, Isaiah draws them out. Verse 7 says, the vineyard of the Lord Almighty is you, nation of Israel. You are the vines he delighted in. But the time passed, and he looked for good grapes. And what did he find? He looked for justice, but saw bloodshed, for righteousness, but heard cries of distress. There's a kind of play on words here, because the words sound quite similar. In English, we could say, he looked for moral greatness, but he saw moral grottiness. He looked for moral light, but he saw moral night. He expected right, but he found a riot. Superficially, yeah, they looked like a good vineyard on the outside, but actually they weren't. It was justice and righteousness he was interested in. This is the faithful exercise of power in the community. Doing the right thing, the loving thing, the fair thing, the generous thing in relation to other people. This is about what a community does with the resources it's been given. It's about how justice is administered. It's about how the poor and the weak are exploited. It's about relationships that are done with righteousness and integrity. And their situation was dire. It stank. And he's saying this is the history of Israel. So much given, nothing spared, lavishly provided for, but producing horrible moral grapes. And it's not just Israel, because this is God's vision of the whole history of humanity. And actually of every single one of us. So much given to us, so much invested in. And God says, what more could I have done? Why am I seeing this stink fruit from people I've invested so much in? The tragedy of unfruitfulness. And God's response to it is like that owner of the vineyard. Ali commented on the bunch of grapes I brought in 3 or 4 weeks ago. That came from a house down our road. And the house has a vine actually growing in the front garden along the fence. And it's quite fine. There are lots of leaves on it, and the bunches of grapes look lovely. And I knocked on the door to ask the owners if I could have a bunch to use for a children's talk. The lady's face was like this. Oh, yeah, you can have one. Take them all. They're horrible. And they aren't nice. They look so good, but you put one in your mouth, and it's just sour. It's sourer than a lemon. And you know that face is the face of God over the unfruitfulness of his people and the people he's made. We need to ask ourselves, how fruitful is God's investment in us? Now, if we're Christians, we shouldn't discount what good fruit there is. but we should also recognize the elements of sourness and bitterness that are there, so that he can then take us on to the next level of fruitfulness. As a church, as a generation of the church in our land, we need to ask the question, are we bearing fruit? It's also a question our society as a whole needs to ask. After all God has given us, what are we doing with it? We think of the money that our society spends on this and that, and the money we only seem to have to spare until very recently to contain, for example, this outbreak of Ebola out in West Africa. So many people so vulnerable. Quite a belated response, it needs to be more. And so many other situations where the priorities of where our national spending goes just seems very different from God's. God says, why, after all I've done for you? And in so many ways we've forgotten him. Well, someone might say, oh, I don't think we're very unfruitful. You've got to be a bit more specific. Well, Isaiah goes into specifics from verse 8 to verse 25. I've called this six clusters of wild grapes, borrowing what I thought was quite a clever idea from one of the commentators. He doesn't actually identify them as wild grapes. In fact, the way they're marked is rather different. They're marked as woes. The heading in the NIV is woes and judgments. And there are six woes here. Remember that number six, because that's going to be significant next week. But for the moment, just concentrate on the fact that these are marked as woes. Woe to you, woe to those, and so on. Woe is not Isaiah pointing a highly judgmental finger in a holier-than-thou way. Woe is an expression a bit like, alas, how awful. Yes, there is judgment in it, but there is also a kind of compassionate concern here because of what is unfolding and what it means. There are six of these woes. And essentially what we see here, in the words of one of the commentators, is Isaiah addressing his situation in his time, which was particularly the emergence of a landed wealthy class. Under the prosperity of King Isaiah, the emergence of this landed wealthy class, which turned its attention more and more to indulgence and pleasure. And we see the corrupting effect of power and money on a society. Now, it's a sample, it's not a total inventory. And because of Isaiah's particular attack on human pride, as particularly featured in verse 15, we see the sins of the high and mighty in their society. Let's go through them. First of all, rampant acquisitiveness. Woe to you who add house to house and join field to field till no space is left and you live alone in the land. This is about people who had the power and position to coerce things so that they could possess more and more and more, building out their estates more and more and more. As someone has said, wanting to possess everything in sight until they could live by themselves in their own little world. This was contrary to one of the basic principles of their law, which is that the land belonged to the Lord, and all his tenants were to have fair shares in it. They have wealth which they've gained by oppression and which can only be held on to by further oppression. And so they indulge in this rampant acquisitiveness. Now we must turn that and look at ourselves and our own society. Is there a rampant acquisitive streak in the consumerism of our day? The accumulation of just more and more stuff. People needing to move house because they haven't got enough storage space. Not just houses, but shoes, shirts, CDs, books, bank balances, share certificates. A rampant acquisitiveness. Isaiah cries woe over it because he sees in verses 9 to 10 the isolation they prize becoming a terrible desolation as the houses empty out and the land loses its fertility. Because greed is always self-defeating in the end. Through greed, good things dissolve away into emptiness, as someone has put it. It was a rampant acquisitiveness. Then in verse 11, he moves on to what I've called a blinkered hedonism. Hedonism is the pursuit of pleasure as the goal of life. Verse 11, woe to those who rise early in the morning to run after their drinks, who stay up late at night till they're inflamed with wine. They have harps and lyres at their banquets, pipes and tambourines and wine. Now, many of the commentators are quick to point out that Isaiah is not condemning wine and music. It's one of the moments you realise again that John Calvin was French when he's very keen to point that out. But he is condemning a kind of blinkered hedonism that is inflamed with pleasure and not with God. I'm reminded of the title of a film made about the Manchester club scene in the 90s. And the film was called 24-Hour Party People. This is what this is describing. The mentality of just living for the weekend and for escape. Look what it does. This is why he's so concerned about it. Second half of verse 12. They have no regard for the deeds of the Lord, no respect for the work of his hands. The tragedy of living for pleasure is that it dulls you to the pleasure of God. And it means you just cease to be able to understand and have proper respect for what God does in the world. It detaches you from a sense of the reality of God because you are so filled up with pleasure in other things. Now, there may be someone here this morning and you're feeling further away from God. There could be many reasons for that. But for somebody, it could be that comfort and pleasure have become too important to you. And there's no space for God and you're just focusing on him, not on him, but on pleasure and with the eyes of blinkered hedonism. Verse 18 moves on to another problem, delusional mockery. Woe to those who draw sin along with cords of deceit and wickedness as with cart ropes. It's a graphic image of the drag that sin is on our lives, and yet we're deceived into thinking it's right. Sin deceives us into thinking it's good for us. And we end up like polar explorers dragging vastly overloaded sledges across the ice to freeze to death. Sin lies to us and we believe the lies and our lives get more and more unfruitful. And with that deception, there often comes a cynicism about God. We're convinced that sin is the key to happiness and life without God is the way to go. And so we mock God. Verse 19. Let God hurry. Let him hasten his work. Come on, let's see it. Bring it on, God. They even take up the phrase that Isaiah maybe even coined, that he uses so much, the Holy One of Israel, to mock him and to mock his sender. They're daring God to punish them. I wonder how often we have our own versions of this, where we insist that if God is real, he really ought to get on with giving us a job or a wedding or a baby or health or wealth or whatever it is. Let God hurry, we say. But saying hurry up God in that impatient way is not the way to bear fruit for him. Because the fruit he wants us to bear includes the slow growing apple of patience. Then we see two sorts of rotten grapes that grow on the same branch. I've called these re-engineering morality and pathologically high self-esteem. Verse 20, woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness. You see, when people get dulled to God and don't think God matters, they start re-engineering the whole vocabulary of morality, changing labels to suit their own preferences, and it's completely rife in our society. Then an interesting phrase, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Because with that is a retraining of moral and spiritual taste buds. And the terrible tragedy is that progressively we cease to enjoy the right things, including God. And we start to enjoy the wrong things, and to enjoy them. Verse 21 shows a pathologically high self-esteem and self-confidence. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes, clever in their own sight. I have to say to you that an elitist academic place like Cambridge is full of people like that. You do not know that it is a terribly fragile thing to be so confident in your own rightness. Then in verse 22, he turns back to the drinking with a slightly different tack to it. I've called it championing drinking rather than the vulnerable. Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine and champions at mixing drinks, who acquit the guilty for a bribe and deny justice to the innocent. This is describing people who think they're great because of how much they can drink. If that doesn't sound so stupid, actually, a lot of people value themselves and value others on that basis. This is about social groups that award informal medals for drunkenness and not for caring about justice. Who cares if I make a difference in society or not, when what really matters is how many beers I can sink and stay on my feet? And it's not just alcohol too. It's about people binging on escapism and becoming dull to quite basic things like whether the poor get justice in this world. There is a particular danger in drink, and this may help some of you who are students. I remember a law student who became a Christian. This is, donkeys years ago. He liked a girl who was coming to Eden. She very wisely wouldn't go out with him, but he started coming along, and he started doing Bible studies with me, and he became a Christian in his third year, and it was wonderful. I remember talking to him, I think it must have been just before a May ball or something, and we were talking about what he would do in the May ball. And he said to me, "Do you know, Julian, most of the things I've done in the last 3 years, which I most regret, have been done when I've had too much to drink." Well, these woes are not an inventory, but a set of examples. And their cumulative effect is this. The poetry, someone has said, presents a society that has lost its centre, lost its reference, lost its focus, lost its purpose, and lost its chance for well-being. A society that's about possessing more and more, spending more and more, pleasing itself more and more, enjoying more and more pleasure, becoming more and more infatuated with its own expertise, finding more and more sophisticated ways to justify it all, mocking more and more openly the idea of a God who acts in history, caring more and more about what doesn't matter, and caring less and less about God and about other people. And it's all in terrible contrast for the kind of fruit that God expects from his vineyard, which is justice and holiness. It's important we hold up this mirror in front of our faces and ask ourselves, what kind of reflection do we see? Is this not, in so many ways, our society? And is this not us to the degree that we've bought into our society's values and practices? The results of these unfruitfulness are shown in verses 24 to 30. Though in fact, it's interleaved through the whole thing. It goes right back to the response of the vineyard owner. He wants to break down the walls and just abandon the vineyard. The way that will happen with Israel and Judah is interleaved through the six woes, with this great culmination in verses 26 to 30, which explains how it will happen. The overall point is that actions have consequences. This world has a moral order to it. The owner of the vineyard will do something to the unfruitful vineyard. God is not absent. He may be invisible, but he is not inactive. Verse 24 describes fire and rot and dust, different ways of expressing failure and destruction. The life draining out of human enterprise and society. Verse 25 may describe an earthquake that actually happened in the time of King Uzziah. It does sound rather like that. But actually, if you'll note, even with the beginnings of decay and the possible earthquake, the Lord's hand is still upraised because more is coming. The hedge has been uprooted, the wall has been dismantled. Now wild boars are going to come to destroy the vineyard. And verses 26 to 30 describe them. And what's coming is not supernatural, although it is driven by God, it's military. A geopolitical process happening at the command of God. He lifts up a banner, and he whistles. I whistle for my dog. The dog comes, at least half the time. When there is a situation of deep unfruitfulness in a society or a nation, God can whistle, and 100% of the time, a human force will come and be his agent of destruction. He's talking about a real army. Almost certainly the Assyrian army, though it seems to spill beyond that into the Babylonians, who came much later. This is a real and terrifying army. A mixture of machine and wild beast from verse 27 to verse 29. And they were coming at his command. For them, it's kind of like the equivalent. What could we say? God whistling and the ISIS forces crossing the border from Syria to Iraq. That's what it felt like for them. And God was saying, I am the one who blew the whistle and made them come. And they will come and ravish the land, and in the end all is left is darkness. This applies in a special way to those who are the people of God, because he does judge his people. But it also applies to all people and all societies. Verse 30 says, in that day. And the day of the Lord in this respect recurs and recurs and recurs. Every individual, every society faces this day one way or the other, either in history or at the final day of history, the final day of the Lord at the ending of history. When God's way is spurned and rejected, he will respond. There is a guiding hand behind the events of history, and sometimes that is guiding hand is behind violent and oppressive and even wicked forces which God uses in his way to bring about his judgment. And the picture is one, if you go back to verse 14, of death just opening its jaws like some kind of reptile that can dislocate its jaws to get more in. And everything just falling in and becoming dark. The humiliation of mankind in verse 15, people being brought low. And in verse 16, the fact that all this is entirely just. This is a very important verse, verse 16. Look at it for a moment. The Lord Almighty will be exalted by his justice, and the Holy God proved holy by his righteous acts. No one will be able to say that what God is doing or has done is unfair or unworthy. At the end of history, when everything is clear, there will be no complaints. We'll all look back and say, no miscarriages of justice. Everything was done in accordance with perfect righteousness and holiness. And God is God. But where does this leave us? Do you remember that description that I mentioned, those of you here in the first sermon, of Isaiah's vision of history, being a vision of history with the holiness of God at the center? Is this where it leaves us? Unfruitful people, unfruitful cities, unfruitful communities, unfruitful churches, unfruitful nations. The hope of the mountain of the Lord from chapter 2 and the branch of the Lord, are they just extinguished in darkness? Look at how chapter 5 ends. If one looks at the land, there is only darkness and distress. Even the sun will be darkened by clouds. The commentators want to draw out what this means. One says, when the Lord has done all, must the darkness of divine wrath close in and the light flicker and fade? Can mercy be exhausted and defeated? Another writes, we finish this long announcement, that's chapters 1 to 5, diminished, bereft, in darkness and distress, hardly daring to hope. That is exactly where this poetry intends us to be. Another writes, the darkness reigns, dark, still and heavy. Another writes, this group of chapters ends without a ray of hope for rebels. If that feels heavy, gloomy, oppressive, if you wish you weren't hearing it, if that, you know, you're getting a negative reaction, you're hearing it right. That's the theological literary point of Isaiah 1 to 5 at this point. It's preparing us for his call in chapter 6, which we'll see next week. As I said, probably the most important chapter in the first half of Isaiah, so do try to be here for it. But actually, we're not going to leave it quite there for today. Because there is something here that points us forward so that we can, just for today, leap over all of that, forward 700 years to Jesus and to that great saying in John 15 where he said, I am the true vine and you are the branches. When Jesus said, I am the true vine, he's doing so with this chapter in mind. What did he mean? Something like this. He meant, I'm doing what Israel couldn't do and what you can't do. Where you're unfruitful, I'm fruitful. I am the one who does bear fruit for God. And then in the most amazing act of generosity and grace and invitation, he says, I'm the true vine. Get connected with me. Join yourselves to me in your unfruitfulness. And I will make you fruitful. Now, we understand from the rest of the New Testament that through his life and his death and his resurrection and the preaching of the gospel and us hearing it and receiving it and the Spirit coming into our lives. At this point, though, just think of that image. The true vine who does bear fruit of righteousness, justice and peace and joy and love and everything else. And us who are so unfruitful, being able just to connect with him, to plug into him, to be joined to him by faith. He's not an electrical circuit. He's not actually just a plant. He's a person. But by faith, we are joined to him. And so our sins are forgiven. Our unfruitfulness is forgiven. And we can be fruitful. And we no longer need to see the face of the owner of that house down our road who screwed up her face when I talked about her grapes. Instead, we can see the smile of God, because when God looks at us, he sees Jesus and what Jesus is doing. Let's go back to the way Isaiah described described the Lord. I will sing for the one I love, he said. Can you say that he is the one you love? There was a preacher who was preaching at the end of his sermon. He announced the hymn, Jesus, Lover of My Soul. And there was a man there that morning who was a total stranger to the gospel. He wasn't a Christian. And he hadn't got much from the sermon, but he heard that expression, Jesus, Lover of My Soul. And that touched his heart. And he said, is Jesus the lover of my soul? Then I love him too. And there and then he gave his heart to Jesus and he joined the church. Friends, in spite of your bitter grapes, in spite of the unfruitfulness of your life, Jesus is the lover of your soul. Turn back to him. Turn to him. See him as the true vine. See him as your beloved. And yet let his love pour through you in greater fruitfulness. Let's pray together. Let's take a moment quietly to respond to what God has said to us through his word. Maybe to think about fruitfulness and unfruitfulness in our lives. And to be real and honest about that. And then to look again to Jesus with the eyes of faith, our true vine and our beloved. We come to you, Lord, with the bunches of sour and bitter grapes of our lives. We look away from them at you. We think of you living for us and dying for us. Lord, we thank you that we can be united with you by faith. We pray we may abide in you and remain in you, that you will take us on to new levels of fruitfulness for you. For your name's sake. Amen.